until they had them eating out of their hands. But that wasn't me. It took all of my courage to simply ask a woman for the time or where Melrose Avenue was. I didn't know anything about anchoring, eliciting values, finding trance words, or these other things Grimble kept talking about. How did I ever get laid without all this technology? It was a quiet Tuesday night in the valley, and the only place Grimble knew to go was the local TGI Fridays. In the car, we warmed up, listening to cassette tapes of Sarge's by Rick H., practicing openers, faking smiles, and dancing in our seats to get energetic. It was one of the most ridiculous things I'd ever done, but I was entering a new world now, with its own rules of behavior. We walked in the door of the restaurant, confident, smiling, alpha. Unfortunately, no one noticed. There were two guys at the bar watching a baseball game on television, a group of business people at a corner table, and a mostly male bar staff. We strutted out to the balcony. As we pushed the door open, a woman appeared. Time to put what I'd learned to the test. "Hey," I said to her, "let me get your opinion on something." She stopped and listened. She was about 4'10", with short frizzy hair and a marshmallow body, but she had a nice smile. She would be good practice. I decided to use the Maury Povich opener. "My friend Grimble there just got a call today from the Maury Povich show," I began, "and it seems they're doing a show on secret admirers. Evidently, someone has a little crush on him. Do you think he should go on the show or not?" "Sure," she answered. "Why not?" "But what if his secret admirer is a man?" I asked. "Talk shows always need to put an unexpected twist on everything. Or what if it's a relative?" "It's not lying. It's flirting." She laughed. "Perfect. Would you do the show?" I asked. "Probably not," she answered. Suddenly, Grimble stepped in. "So you would make me go on the show, but you wouldn't do it yourself?" he teased her. "You're not adventurous at all, are you?" It was great to watch him work. Where I would have let the conversation wane into small talk, he was already leading her somewhere sexual. "I am," she protested. "Then prove it to me," he said, smiling. "Let's try a little exercise. It's called synesthesia." He took a step closer to her. "Have you ever heard of synesthesia? It will enable you to find all kinds of resources to accomplish and feel the things you want in life. Synesthesia is the nerve gas in the arsenal of the speed seducer. Literally, it is an overlapping of the senses. In the context of seduction, however, synesthesia refers to a type of waking hypnosis in which a woman is put into a heightened state of awareness and told to imagine pleasurable images and sensations growing in intensity. The goal? To make her uncontrollably aroused. She agreed and closed her eyes. I was finally going to get to hear one of Ross's secret patterns. But as soon as Grimble began, a stocky red-faced jock wearing a pocket undershirt marched up to him. "What are you doing?" he asked Grimble. "I was showing her a self-improvement exercise called synesthesia." "Well, that's my wife." I had forgotten to check for a wedding ring, though I doubted minor inconveniences like marriage mattered to Grimble. "Go disarm the guy," Grimble turned to me and hissed, "while I work on the girl." I had no idea how to disarm him. He didn't seem quite as laid back as Scott Baio. "He can show you the exercise too," I said wanly. "It's really cool." "I don't know what the fuck you're talking about," the guy said. "What is this thing supposed to do to me?" He took a step closer and leaned his face into mine. He smelled like whiskey and onion rings. "It tells you whether, I stammered. "Never mind." The guy lifted his hands and pushed me backward. Though I tell girls I'm 5'8", I'm actually 5'6". The top of my head just reached his shoulders. "Stop it," his wife, our former Sarge, said. She turned to us. "He's drunk. He gets like this." "Like what?" I asked. "Violent?" She smiled sadly. "You seem like a great couple," I said. My attempt to disarm him had clearly failed, because he was about to disarm me. His red, drunken face was 2 inches from mine and yelling about ripping something. "Pleasure meeting you both," I squeaked, slowly backing away. "Remind me," Grimble said as we retreated to the car, "to teach you how to handle the AMOG."
"The AMOG?"
"Yes, the alpha male of the group."
"Oh, I see."
Chapter 7. 4 days later, as I sat at home alone on a Saturday afternoon, watching the videos Grimble had given me, he called with good news. He and his wing two-timer were going to meet Ross Jeffries at California Pizza Kitchen for an expedition to the Getty Museum, and I was invited. I arrived 15 minutes early, selected a booth, and read through printouts of seduction board posts until Ross, Grimble, and Two-Timer arrived. Two-Timer had black hair, gelled to the texture of a licorice vine, a matching leather jacket, and a snake-like quality. With his round, babyish face, he looked like a Grimble clone who'd been inflated by a bicycle pump. As I stood up to introduce myself, Ross cut me off. He was not the most polite person I'd ever met. He wore a long wool overcoat, which flowed loosely around his legs when he walked. He was thin and gawky, with gray stubble and greasy skin. His hairline was a receding mop of short, unkempt, ash-colored curls, and the hook in his nose was so pronounced he could have hung his overcoat on it.
"So, what did you learn from mystery?" Ross asked with a sneer.
"A lot," I told him.
"Like what?"
"Well, one of my sticking points was knowing when a girl was attracted to me. Now I know."
"And how do you know?" he asked.
"When I get 3 indicators of interest."
"Name them."
"Let's see. When she asks you what your name is?"
"That's 1.
"When you take her hands in yours and squeeze them, and she squeezes back?"
"That's 2.
And, I can't remember the rest right now."
"Aha!"
He leapt to his feet. "Then he's not a very good teacher, is he?"
"No, he was a great teacher," I protested.
"Then name the 3rd indicator of interest."
"I can't think of it right now."
I felt like an animal backed into a corner.
"Case closed," he said. He was good.
A short waitress with blue nails, a touch of baby fat, and sandy brown hair arrived to take our order. Ross looked at her and then winked at me. "These are my students," he told her. "I'm their guru."
"Really?"
she asked, feigning interest.
"What would you say if I told you that I teach people how to use mind control to attract any person they desire?"
"Get out of here."
"Yes, it's true.
I could make you fall in love with any person at this table."
"And how's that, with mind control?"
She was skeptical, but bordering on curious.
"Let me ask you something. When you're really attracted to somebody, how do you know? In other words, what signals do you get from yourself, inside, that allow you to realize?" And here he lowered his voice, slowly pronouncing each word. "You're really attracted to this guy." The purpose of the question, I would find out later, was to make the waitress feel the emotion of attraction in his presence, and thus associate those feelings with his face. She thought about it for a moment.
"Well, I got a funny feeling in my stomach, like butterflies, when I met my ex-boyfriend."
Ross put his hand palm up in front of his stomach.
"Yes, and I bet that the more attracted you become, the more those butterflies rise up from your stomach." He began slowly raising his hand to the level of his heart, "until your face begins to flush, like it is right now."
Two-Timer leaned over and whispered, "That's anchoring. It's when you associate a physical feeling, like attraction, with a touch or gesture. Now, every time Ross raises his hand like that, she gets attracted to him." After a few more minutes of Ross's flirtatious hypnospeak, the waitress's eyes began to glaze over. Ross seized the opportunity to toy with her mercilessly. He raised his hands like an elevator from his stomach to his face every few seconds, smiling as it made her blush every time. The dishes she was carrying were forgotten, balancing precariously on her weakening arm. "What made you break up with your boyfriend?" Ross asked after a while. "He was too immature." Ross seized the opportunity. Well, you should date more mature men.
I was just thinking that about you as we were talking, she giggled.
I bet that when you first came to the table, I was the last person you thought you'd be attracted to.
It's strange, she said, because you're not my usual type.
Ross suggested they get together for coffee when she wasn't working, and she jumped at the opportunity to give him her phone number. His technique was so different than Mystery's, but he seemed to be the real deal, too.
As we left the restaurant, Ross ran the exact same routine on the hostess and collected her number. Both women were in their 20s. Ross was in his 40s. I was floored.
We pressed into Ross's Saab and headed to the Getty.
Anything you want from a woman, attraction, lust, fascination, is just an internal process that she runs through her body and her brain, he explained as he drove. And all you need to evoke that process are questions that make her go into her body and brain and actually experience it in order to answer you. Then she will link those feelings of attraction to you.
Sitting in the back seat with me, Two-Timer scanned my face for a reaction.
What do you think? He asked.
Amazing, I said.
Evil, he corrected, letting a thin smile creep over his lips.
When we arrived at the Getty, Two-Timer turned his attention to Ross.
I wanted to ask you about the October Man sequence, he prodded. I've been switching around a few of the steps.
Ross turned to him. You understand that these things are very bad.
As he spoke, Ross wagged a finger at Two-Timer's chest, over his heart. He was anchoring again, trying to associate the notion of badness with the forbidden pattern. There's a reason I don't teach them at my seminars. It's like giving dynamite to children.
Two-Timer smiled again. I could tell exactly what he was thinking, because in my mind, the word evil was anchored to that smile.
Darwin talked about survival of the fittest, Two-Timer explained to me as we walked through the museum's collection of pre-20th century art. In earlier times, this meant that the strong survived, but strength doesn't help one get ahead in society today. Women breed with seducers who understand how to trigger the fantasy parts of the female brain. There was something artificial and rehearsed about the way he spoke, the way he moved, the way he looked at me. It felt as if he were sucking my soul into his eyes. So the whole idea of survival of the fittest is an anachronism. As players, we stand at the gate of a new era, the survival of the smoothest.
I liked the idea, though unfortunately I was no smoother than I was strong. My voice was fast and choppy, my movements effete, my body language awkward. For me, survival was going to take work.
Casanova was one of us, Two-Timer went on, but we live a better lifestyle.
Well, it probably took a lot more work to seduce a woman back then because of the morals of the day, I said, trying to contribute something useful.
And we have the technology.
You mean NLP?
Not just that. He had to work alone.
He grinned as his gaze bored deeper into my eyes.
We have each other.
We lurked through the galleries, gazing at the people gazing at paintings. I watched as Grimble and Two-Timer talked to various women. I was far too scared to approach in front of Ross. It felt like trying to play the cello in front of Yo-Yo Ma. I was afraid he'd criticize everything I did or get upset that I wasn't using enough of his technology. On the other hand, this was a guy who advised students to get over their fear of approaching by walking up to random women and saying, "Hi, I'm Manny the Martian. What's your favorite flavor of bowling ball?" So I really didn't have to worry about looking foolish in front of him. He created fools. At the end of the day, Ross had three numbers. Two-Timer and Grimble had two each, and I had nothing. As we took the train downhill to the museum parking lot, Ross slid into the seat next to me.
Listen, he said, I have a seminar coming up in a few months, and I will let you sit in and take it for free.
Thanks, I said.
I am going to be your guru, not Mystery. You'll see that what I am teaching is 100 times more powerful.
I wasn't sure how to respond. They were competing over me, an AFC, an average frustrated chump.
And one more thing, Ross said. In exchange,
I want you to take me to 5, no 6, Hollywood parties with super hot babes. He smiled and asked, "Do we have a deal?" as he rubbed his thumb on his chin. I was sure he was anchoring me. Step 3. Demonstrate value. Chapter 1. The best predators don't lie on the jungle floor with their teeth bared and claws out. The prey is going to avoid them. They approach the prey slowly and harmlessly, win its trust, and then attack. At least, that's what Sin told me. He facetiously called it Sin Method. Though Mystery had flown back to Toronto after the workshop, I stayed in touch with Sin. I'd watch as a woman came over to his house for the first time, and he'd throw her against the wall by her neck, then release her just before he kissed her, shooting her adrenaline level through the roof with equal parts fear and arousal. Then he'd cook her dinner and never speak a word about it until dessert, when he'd stare at her like a tiger eyeing its prey and say, in a tone of restrained lust, "You don't even want to know the things I'm thinking of doing to you right now." That was generally the point when I'd excuse myself to go home. Along with the sneakier Grimple, the more predatory Sin became a faithful wing. But our friendship didn't last long. One afternoon, after a sergeant session at the Beverly Center Mall, Sin informed me that he'd enrolled in the Air Force as an officer. "The military's a steady paycheck," he explained as we sat in a mall cafe, "and I can live wherever I want. I've been an unemployed computer programmer for too long." I tried to talk him out of it. Sin was into astral projection, goth rock, S&M, and pickup. He would have to hide all that if he joined the military. But his mind was made up. "I was talking to Mystery about you," he said, leaning low over the metal latticework of the table. His tone, as always, was deadly serious. He wants to schedule his next workshop in December. Since I'm not going to be around to wing him, he wants you to do it. As I thought of another weekend with Mystery and all his secrets, like the triple stacked patterns he used to move girls to tears, I tried to control the excitement in my voice. "I think I'll be free," I said. Out of all the potential pickup artists in the world, I couldn't believe that Mystery was choosing me. He must not know that many people. There was just one small problem. I wasn't going to be free in December. I'd booked a flight to Belgrade to visit Marco, the schoolmate who had introduced me to Dustin and his natural ways. It was too late to cancel on Marco, but there was no way I was going to miss the opportunity to wing Mystery either. There had to be a solution. That night, I called Mystery in Toronto, where he was living with his parents, his two nieces, his sister, and her husband. "Hey, buddy," Mystery said when he answered. "I'm bored out of my mind here." I find that hard to believe. "Well, it's raining, and I want to go out, but I have no one to go out with and no clue where to go." He paused to tell his nieces to shut up. "I'll probably just get some sushi alone." I'd assumed that the great Mystery would have girls lined up every night of the week and a wait list of sergers eager to take him out clubbing. Instead, he was stagnating at home. His father was sick, his mother was overburdened, and his sister was separating from her husband. "Can't you go out with Patricia?" I asked. Patricia was Mystery's girlfriend, the one pictured in her negligee in his pickup resume. "She's mad at me," he said. Mystery had met Patricia 4 years ago, when she was fresh off the boat from Romania. He tried to mold her into his ideal girl. He talked her into getting a boob job, giving him blowjobs, which she'd never done before, and taking a job as a stripper, but she drew the line at bisexuality. For Mystery, this was a deal breaker. Everyone has their own reason for getting into the game. Some, like Extra Mask, are virgins who want to experience what it's like to be with a woman. Others, like Grimble and Two-Timer, desire new girls every night. And a few, like Sweater, are searching for the perfect wife. Mystery had his own specific goal. "I want to be loved by two women," he said. "I want a blonde 10 and an Asian 10, who will love each other as much as they love me. And Patricia's heterosexuality is affecting my sex life with her, because unless I imagine another girl there, I can't always keep my boner." He moved the phone to another room because his sister and her husband were arguing, and continued, "I'd just break up with Patricia, but there aren't any tens in Toronto. No outrageous glitter girls. It's all sevens at best." "Move to LA," I urged. "This is where all the peacocky girls you like live." "Yeah, I really need to get out of here," he sighed. "So I want to schedule a bunch of workshops. I've got people interested in Miami, Chicago, and New York. How about Belgrade?" "What? Isn't there a war going on there?" "No, the war's over, and I have to visit an old friend. He said it's safe. We can stay with him for free, and Slavic women are supposed to be the most beautiful in the world." He hesitated. "And I have a free companion ticket." Silence. He was considering it. I pushed further. "What the hell? It's an adventure. At the very worst, you'll have a new picture for your photo routine." Mystery thought like a flowchart, and if he agreed to do something, his assent was given instantly and always with the same word, which he spoke next. "Done." "Great," I said. "I'll email you the flight times." I couldn't wait for the 10-hour plane ride. I wanted to vacuum every piece of knowledge, every magic trick, every pickup line, every story out of his head. I wanted to mimic exactly what I'd seen him do, word for word, trick for trick, simply because it worked. "But wait," he said, "there's something else." "What?" "If you're going to be my wing, you can't be Neil Strauss," he said, with the same air of finality with which he had spoken the word "done." "It's time for you to change, to just snap and become someone else. Think about it. Neil Strauss, writer. That isn't cool. Nobody wants to sleep with a writer. They're at the bottom of the social ladder. You must be a superstar. And not just with women. You are an artist in need of an art. And I think that your art is actually the social skills you're learning. I watched you in the field. You adapted quickly. That's why Sid and I picked you. Hold on a minute." I heard him rustling through some papers. "Listen," he said. "These are my personal development goals. I want to raise the money for a touring illusion show. I want to live in posh hotels. I want a limo to and from shows. I want specials on TV with big illusions. I want to levitate over Niagara Falls. I want to travel to England and Australia. I want jewelry, games, a model airplane, a personal assistant, a stylist, and I want to act in Jesus Christ Superstar as Jesus." At least he knew what he wanted in life. "What I'm really after," he finally said, "is for people to be envious of me, for women to want me and men to want to be me. You never got much love as a child, did you?" "No," he replied sheepishly. At the end of the conversation, he said he was going to email me the password to a secret online community called Mysteries Lounge. He had created Mysteries Lounge 2 years before, after an enterprising bartender he'd slept with in Los Angeles found an internet post he'd written about her on a public seduction newsgroup. After spending a weekend poring through the rest of his online archive, she emailed Mystery's girlfriend Patricia and told her about her boyfriend's extracurricular activities. The fallout nearly destroyed his relationship, and in the process taught him that there was a downside to being a pickup artist: getting caught. Unlike the other seduction boards I had been reading, where hundreds of newbies were constantly begging for advice from just a few experts, Mystery had cherry-picked the best pickup artist in the community for his private forum. Here, they not only shared their secrets, stories, and techniques, but also posted pictures of themselves and their women, even on occasion, video and audio recordings of their exploits in the field. "But remember," Mystery said sternly, "you are no longer Neil Strauss. When I see you in there, I want you to be someone else. You need a seduction name." He paused and reflected. "Styles? How about style? That was one thing I prided myself on. I may never have been socially comfortable, but at least I knew how to dress better than those who were. Style it is. Mystery and style." Yes, it was Mystery and Style giving a workshop. It had a nice ring to it. Style the pickup artist, teaching lovable losers how to meet the women of their dreams. But as soon as I hung up, I realized something. First, Style needed to teach himself. After all, it had only been a month since my first workshop with Mystery. I still had a long way to go. It was time for a motherfucking change. Chapter 2. One of my teenage heroes was Harry Crosby. He was a poet from the 1920s, and frankly, his poetry sucked. But his lifestyle was legendary. The nephew and godson of J.P. Morgan, he hobnobbed with Ernest Hemingway and D.H. Lawrence, was the first person to publish parts of Joyce's Ulysses, and became a decadent symbol of the lost generation. He lived a fast, opium-enhanced life, and swore he would be dead by the age of 30. When he was 22, he married Polly Peabody, the inventor of the strapless bra, and persuaded her to change her name to Caress. For their honeymoon, they locked themselves in a bedroom in Paris with stacks of books and just read. At the age of 31, when he realized that his lifestyle hadn't killed him yet, Crosby shot himself. I didn't have a Caress to lock up with me, but I shut myself in the house for a week, Harry Crosby style, reading books, listening to tapes, watching videos, and studying the seduction posts in Mystery's Lounge. I immersed myself in seduction theory. I needed to shed Neil Strauss and rewire myself to become style. I wanted to live up to Mystery and Sin's faith in me. To do so, I'd have to change not just the things I said to women, but the way I acted around them. I needed to become confident, to become interesting, to become decisive, to become graceful, to become the alpha male I was never raised to be. I had a lot of lost time to make up for, and 6 weeks to do it in. I bought books on body language, flirting, and sexual technique. I read anthologies of women's sexual fantasies, like Nancy Friday's Secret Garden, in order to internalize the idea that women actually want sex as much as, if not more than, men. They just don't want to be pressured, lied to, or made to feel like a slut. I ordered books on marketing, like David Cialdini's seminal Influence, from which I learned several key principles that guide the majority of people's decisions. The most important of these is social proof, which is the notion that if everyone is doing something, then it must be good. So, if you're in a bar with a beautiful female friend on your arm, a pivot, as they call it in the community, it's much easier to meet women than if you're hanging out alone. I watched the videos Grimble had given me and took notes on each, memorizing affirmations and patterns. There is a difference between a line and a pattern. A line is basically any prepared comment made to a woman. A pattern is a more elaborate script, specifically designed to arouse her. Men and women think and respond differently. Show a man the cover of Playboy and he's ready to go. In fact, show him a pitted avocado and he's ready to go. Women, according to the speed seducers, aren't persuaded as easily by direct images and talk. They respond better to metaphor and suggestion. It wasn't enough, though, for me just to study Ross Jeffries. A lot of his ideas are simply applications of neurolinguistic programming. So I went to the source and bought books by Richard Bandler and John Grinder, two University of California professors who developed and popularized this fringe school of hypnopsychology in the 1970s. After NLP, it was time to learn some of Mystery's tricks. I spent $150 at magic stores buying videos and books on levitation, metal bending, and mind reading. I'd learned from Mystery that one of the most important things to do with an attractive woman was to demonstrate value. In other words, what makes me any different from the last 20 guys who approached her? Well, if I can bend her fork by looking at it, or guess her name before even speaking to her, that's a little different. To further demonstrate value, I bought books on handwriting analysis, rune reading, and tarot cards. After all, everyone's favorite subject is himself. I took notes on everything I studied, developing routines and stories to test in the field. I neglected my work, my friends, and my family. I was on an 18-hour-a-day mission. When I finally crammed as much information in my brain as it could hold, I started working on body language. I signed up for lessons in swing and salsa dancing. I rented Rebel Without a Cause and A Streetcar Named Desire to practice the looks and poses of James Dean and Marlon Brando. I studied Pierce Brosnan in the remake of The Thomas Crown Affair, Brad Pitt in Meet Joe Black, Mickey Rourke in Wild Orchid, Jack Nicholson in The Witches of Eastwick, and Tom Cruise in Top Gun. I looked at every aspect of my physical behavior. Were my arms swinging when I walked? Did they bow out a little, as if trying to get around massive pectorals? Did I walk with a confident swagger? Could I stick my chest out further, hold my head up higher, swing my legs out wider, as if they were trying to get around massive genitalia? After correcting what I could on my own, I signed up for a course on Alexander technique to improve my posture and rid myself of the round-shouldered curse I'd inherited from my father's side of the family. And because no one ever understands a word I say, my voice is too fast, quiet, and mumbly, I started taking weekly private lessons in speech and singing. I wore stylish jackets with bright shirts and accessorized as much as I could. I bought rings, a necklace, and fake piercings. I experimented with cowboy hats, feather boas, light-up necklaces, and even sunglasses at night to see which received the most attention from women. In my heart, I knew most of these gaudy accoutrements were tacky, but Mystery's peacock theory worked. When I wore at least one item that stood out, women who were interested in meeting me had an easy way to start a conversation. I went out with Grimble, Two-Timer, and Ross Jeffries nearly every night, and chunk by chunk, learned a new way to interact. Women are sick of generic guys asking the same generic questions. So where are you from? What do you do for work? With our patterns, gimmicks, and routines, we were barroom heroes, saving the female of the species from certain ennui. Not all women appreciated our efforts, of course. Though I was never hit, yelled at, or doused with a drink in a club, stories of spectacular failures circled constantly in the back of my mind. There was the story of Little Big Dick, a sergeant from Alaska, who was sitting at a table talking to a girl when her boyfriend came up behind him, yanked him out of his seat, threw him to the ground, and kicked him in the head for 2 minutes straight, fracturing his left eye socket and leaving boot marks on his face. But they were the exceptions, I hoped. These beatdowns were foremost in my mind as I drove my car to Westwood, home to UCLA, for my first attempt at sergeant during the daytime. Despite the cheat sheet of my favorite openers and routines in the back pocket of my jeans, I was petrified as I roamed the streets, trying to select someone for my first approach. As I walked past an Office Depot, I saw a woman with brown glasses and short blonde hair that danced on her shoulders. She was thin with smooth, gentle curves, jeans that were just tight enough, and a beautiful complexion, like burned butter. She looked like the undiscovered treasure of the campus. She walked into the store, and I decided to move on. But then I saw her again through the window. She looked like a cool intellectual whose inner bombshell hadn't blossomed yet, someone I could talk with about Tarkovsky movies and then take to a monster truck rally. Maybe this would be my caress. I knew that if I didn't approach her, I'd chastise myself afterward and feel like a failure. So I decided to attempt my first daytime pickup. Besides, I told myself, she probably wasn't that good-looking up close anyway. I walked into the store and found her in an aisle looking at mailing envelopes. "Hey, maybe you can help me settle a debate I'm having," I told her. As I recited the Maury Povich opener, I noticed that she was even more beautiful at close range. I had stumbled across a genuine 10, and I had to follow protocol and neg her. "I know this is wrong to say," I blurted, "but I grew up on Bugs Bunny cartoons as a child, and you have the most adorable Bugs Bunny overbite." I was worried I'd gone too far. I'd made the neg up on the spot and was probably about to get slapped, but she actually grinned. "After all those years of braces, my mom's gonna be mad," she replied. She was flirting back with me. I performed the ESP routine, and fortunately, she picked 7. She was amazed. I asked her what she did for work, and she said she was a model and hosted a show on TNN. The longer we talked, the more she seemed to enjoy the conversation. But as I noticed the material working, I became nervous. I couldn't believe that a woman who looked like this was into me. Everyone in Office Depot was staring at us. I couldn't go on. I'm late for an appointment, I told her. My hands were shaking from nerves. But what steps can we take to continue this conversation? This was Mystery's number close routine. A pickup artist never gives a girl his phone number because she might not call. A PUA, or pickup artist, must make a woman comfortable enough to give him her number. He must also avoid asking for it directly because she could always say no, and instead, he must lead her to suggest the idea herself. I could give you my number, she offered. She wrote down her name, followed by her number and her email address. I couldn't believe it. I don't go out much, though, she warned, as an afterthought. Maybe she was already having regrets. When I returned home, I pulled the scrap of paper out of my pocket and placed it in front of the computer. Since she was supposedly a model, I wanted to look for a picture of her online. She had only given me her first name, Daylene, but fortunately her email address contained her last name, Curtis. I typed the words into Google, and nearly 100,000 results came up. I had just number closed the reigning Playmate of the Year. Chapter 3. I sat in front of my phone and stared at Daylene Curtis's number every evening, but I couldn't bring myself to call. I wasn't confident and good-looking enough for this perfect specimen of femininity. I mean, what was I going to do on a date with her? I remember meeting a girl named Elisa for lunch at a summer job when I was 17. I was so nervous, I couldn't stop my hands from shaking or my voice from quavering. And the more awkward I became, the more uncomfortable she grew. By the time the food arrived, I was too self-conscious even to chew in front of her. It was a disaster, and it wasn't even a date. So what hope did I have with the Playmate of the Year? There's a word for this. Unworthiness. I felt unworthy. So I waited 3 days to call, then put it off to the next day, and then decided that calling on the weekend would sound like I had no social life. So I figured I'd call her on Monday, and by then a week had passed. She'd probably forgotten about me. We'd talked for 10 minutes at most, and it had been, admittedly, a soft close. I was just some weird, interesting guy she had met in an office supply store. There was no reason this woman, who could have her choice of any man in the hemisphere, would want to see me again. So I never called. I was my own worst enemy. My first legitimate success didn't come until a week later, when I was eating a burrito at La Salsa with Extra Mask. At a table nearby, there was an attractive but slightly unkempt woman stuffing receipts into a bulging Filofax. She had long, curly brown hair, tiny ferret-like features, and immense breasts that refused to be concealed by her sweatshirt. I broke the 3-second rule by about 250 seconds, but finally worked up the confidence to approach. I didn't want to look like an AFC in front of Extra Mask. I've been taking a course in handwriting analysis, I told her. While we're waiting for our food, do you mind if I practice on you? She looked at me skeptically, but then decided I was harmless and consented. I handed her my notebook and told her to write a sentence in it. Interesting, I said. Your handwriting has no slant. It's straight up and down, which means you're a self-sufficient person and don't always need to be around others to feel good about yourself. With each tidbit I told her, she leaned in closer and nodded in agreement. She had a wonderful smile and was easy to talk to. She'd just finished a comedy class nearby, she said, and offered to read me some jokes from her notebook. I opened my shows with this one, she said after my analysis. I just got back from the gym and boy are my arms tired. This was her opener. She had it on a cheat sheet that she kept in her back pocket. Picking up women, I realized, was a lot like stand-up comedy or any other performing art. They require openers, routines, and a memorable close, plus the ability to make it all seem new every time. She said she was spending the night at a hotel in town, so I offered to drive her there. As I dropped her off, I pointed to my cheek and said, "Kiss goodbye." She kissed my cheek. Extra Mask kicked the back of my seat excitedly. Then I told her I had work to do but that I'd call her for a drink when I was finished. Before leaving to pick her up later that night, I printed out one of the forbidden Ross Jeffries patterns Grimble had emailed me. I was determined to make up for my recent mistakes. We went to a dive bar and had a drink. She had changed into a frayed blue sweater and saggy jeans, which made her look somewhat dumpy. Nonetheless, I was happy to be on an actual date with a woman I'd picked up. Finally, I had an opportunity to experiment with more advanced material. "There's a way," I told her, "that you can bring better focus to your goals in your life." I felt like Grimble in TGI Fridays. "What's that?" she asked. "It's a visualization exercise. A friend taught it to me. I don't know it by heart, but I can read it to you." She wanted to hear it. "Good," I said, as I unfolded the paper with the pattern on it and began reading. "Maybe you can try to remember the last time you felt happiness or pleasure. As you feel it now, where in your body are those feelings?" She pointed to the center of her chest. "Okay, now, as you focus in on this feeling right here, notice that you can begin now to see a color flowing from this feeling. What's that color?" "Purple," she said, as she closed her eyes. As I read the pattern, her body began to relax. I could see her chest rise and fall through her blue sweatshirt. I was doing it now, evoking a response like the one I had seen Ross Jeffries get at California Pizza Kitchen. I continued with the pattern more confidently, making the color expand and grow in intensity inside her as she fell deeper into trance. I imagined Two-Timer mouthing the word evil in the background. I had her shrink all that color to a tiny purple pea that contained all the power and intensity of the pleasure she was feeling. I had her place the imaginary pea in my hand. Then I traced my hand all along her body, first at a distance and then lightly touching it. To be honest, I had no idea whether this was turning her on or not. She didn't start sucking my fingers like the girl in Grimble's story. In fact, I felt not only a little stupid, but also lecherous using the pretext of hypnosis to touch her. I didn't like these forbidden patterns. I got into the game to learn confidence, not mind control. I folded the piece of paper, put it in my pocket, and drove her back to her hotel. But instead of dropping her off, I pulled into the garage. We climbed out of the car, and I followed her to her room. I was too scared to say a word, afraid she might suddenly turn on me and ask, "Why are you following me?" But she seemed to have mentally consented. It looked like we're going to have sex tonight. I couldn't believe my luck. After all that practice, I was finally getting results. According to Mystery, it takes roughly 7 hours for a woman to be comfortably led from meat to sex. These 7 hours can take place all in one night or over several days, approaching and talking for an hour, speaking on the phone for an hour, meeting for drinks for 2 hours, talking on the phone for another half hour, and then, on the next meeting, hanging out for 2 more hours before going to bed together. Waiting 7 hours or more is what Mystery calls solid game. But occasionally, a woman either goes out with the specific intention of taking someone home, or can easily be led to sex in a shorter amount of time. Mystery calls this fool's mate. I had spent an hour with this girl at La Salsa and 2 hours at the bar. I was about to experience my first fool's mate. She put the card key in the lock of her room and the green light appeared, an omen I felt of the night of passion to come. She opened the door and I followed her inside. She sat on the foot of the bed, just like in the movies, and pulled her shoes off. First the left, then the right. She was wearing white socks, which I found rather endearing. She flexed the toes of both feet upward, then curled them downward as she collapsed backward on the bed. I took a step toward her, prepared to fall on her in an embrace. But suddenly, the foulest smell I have ever encountered assailed my nostrils. It literally pushed me backward. It was the exact rancid cheese smell that homeless alcoholics on New York subways have. The kind that clears the whole subway car. No matter how many steps back I took, the intensity of the smell did not diminish. It filled the entire room, every available space. I looked at her, lying back on the bed, wanton, oblivious. It was her feet. Her feet were stinking up the room. I had to get out of there. Chapter 4. How do you kiss a girl? The distance between you is just 3 inches. It's not a long stretch by any standard. You barely even have to move your body to bridge the gap. Yet, it is the most difficult 3 inches a man has to move in his life. It is the moment when the male must concede all the privileges that are his birthright, put his pride, ego, esteem, and hard work aside, and just hope. Hope that she doesn't deflect it with her cheek, or even worse, the let's just be friends speech. As I went out every night, training to wing Mystery's workshop, I soon developed a routine that worked, at least to a point. Rejection wasn't an option. I knew how to open a group, respond to most contingencies, and leave with a phone number and a plan to meet again. Every time I went home, I reviewed the events of the night, looking for parts of a Sarge that I could have done better. If the approach didn't work, I thought of ways to improve it. Angles of advance, back turns, takeaways, time constraints. If I didn't get the phone number, I didn't blame it on the girl for being cold or bitchy, as so many other Sargers did. I blamed myself and analyzed every word, gesture, and reaction until I pinpointed a tactical error. I had read in a book called Introducing NLP that there is no such thing as failure, only learning lessons. I wanted the learning lessons to take place in my head so that in the field I was flawless. I would have to prove myself to Mystery's students, just as Sin had proven himself to me. And one public failure would discredit everything. The students would post reviews saying that Style was an imposter, a joke. But there was still one problem I couldn't work through. Though an opener, a neg, and a demonstration of higher value were enough to get anyone's phone number, I had no idea what to do next. No one had taught me. I mean, I technically knew the words of the Mystery kiss close, "Would you like to kiss me?" But I was too petrified to actually speak them. After spending so much time bonding with a girl, whether for half an hour in a club or several hours at our next meeting, I was too scared to break the rapport and trust I had built. Unless she gave me a clear indication that she was sexually interested in me, I felt like trying to kiss her would disappoint her, and she'd think I was just like all the other guys. It was such stupid AFC thinking. There was still a nice guy lurking in my head that I had to get rid of. But, unfortunately, there wasn't going to be time to do so before Belgrade. Chapter 5. I'd learned several sleights of hand, a principle of magic called equivoque, the fundamentals of rune reading, and a way to make lit cigarettes disappear. It had been the most productive plane trip of my life. And now, Mystery and I were in Belgrade, at possibly the worst time of the year. Ice and slush lay heavy on the street as Marco drove us to his apartment in a silver 1987 Mercedes that had a habit of stalling every time he put it into second gear. Mystery, hair unwashed and held back in a greasy ponytail, fumbled through his backpack in the front seat, producing a long black overcoat. He had cut away the bottom third of the coat and sewn in its place black fabric covered with stars. It looked like something one would wear to a Renaissance fair. Mystery had made his ring himself, too, painting an eyeball on the plastic surface. He was clearly more of a geek than I had ever been. His greatest illusion was transforming himself into a good-looking player every night he went out. "You're going to have to shave your head," he said as he looked at me. "No thanks. What if I have a strange-shaped skull or weird marks on my head like my dad?" "Look at you. You're wearing glasses because your vision sucks. You have a hat on to cover a huge bald spot. You're ghostly white, and you look like you haven't seen the inside of a gym since grade school. You're doing well because you're smart and you're a fast learner. But looks count too. You're style, so start being style. Just snap. Shave your head, get LASIK, join a gym." He was a very persuasive geek. He turned to Marco. Is there a barber shop around here? Unfortunately, there was. Marco pulled in front of a small building, and we walked inside to find an elderly Serbian man presiding over an empty shop. Mystery sat me in a chair, told Marco to instruct the barber to remove my tumbleweeds, and then supervise the procedure to make sure the barber shaved down to the skull. Balding is not a choice, but bald is a choice, he said. If anyone asks you why your head is shaved, tell them, I used to have it down past my ass, but then I realized I was covering up my best feature. He laughed. Or you could say, well, most Greco-Roman wrestlers shave their heads. I made a mental note to add both replies to my cheat sheet. When the barber finished, I looked in the mirror and saw a chemo patient staring back at me. It looks good, Mystery said. Let's see if there's a tanning salon around here. We'll have you looking like a thug in no time. Okay, but I'm not getting LASIK in Serbia. My first thought once I was shaven-headed and tan was, what took me so long? I looked much better. I had transformed from a 5 to a 6.5 on the attractiveness scale. This trip was turning out to be a good idea. Marco looked as if he could use a makeover himself. A big-boned 6'2", he was much stockier than most Serbians, with an olive complexion and the out-of-proportion head of a Peanuts character. He wore a wool overcoat that was one size too big, a thick gray J. Crew sweater with flecks of white, and a cream-colored turtleneck that actually made him look like a turtle. Marco had been unable to live his dream of being a high-society socialite after graduating from college in America, so he'd moved to a smaller pond, Serbia, where his father was a well-known artist. He drove us to his one-bedroom apartment, which contained only a cot and a twin bed. Because there was no sleeping bag or even a couch, we agreed to take turns sharing the larger bed. While Mystery showered, Marco pulled me aside. What are you doing with this guy? What do you mean? I mean, he's totally beneath us. We went to the Latin school. We went to Vassar. This is not the kind of guy who can fit in at these places. He's not one of us. I know, you're right. But trust me, this guy will change your life. Well, Marco said, we'll see. I met a girl last month who's different than all the rest, and I want to do it right. So make sure Mystery doesn't ruin it with all his pickup tricks and embarrass me. Marco hadn't dated a single woman since he'd moved to Belgrade. But a few months ago, through a friend of his, he'd met a girl named Gocha, and he was sure she was the one. He took her out on dates, he bought her flowers, he treated her to dinner, and he dropped her off at home afterward, like a perfect gentleman. Have you slept with her yet? I asked him. No, I haven't even kissed her. Dude, you're behaving like a total AFC. One day, a guy is going to walk up to her in a club, say, do you think magic spells work, and take her home. She wants an adventure. She wants to have sex. All girls do. Well, Marco said, she's different from all those girls. People have more class here than they do in LA. The Puas had a name for this. They called it one-itis. It's a disease AFCs get. They become obsessed with a girl they're neither dating nor sleeping with, and then start acting so needy and nervous around her that they end up driving her away. The cure for one-itis, Puas like to say, is to go out and have sex with a dozen other girls, and then see if this flower is still so special. Chapter 6. The prop bag I wore to the Belgrade workshop was black, Armani, and the size of a hardcover novel, with a single shoulder strap so that it could be slung artfully across my torso. With so many magic tricks, gimmicks, and other tools of the trade necessary to use in the field, it was impossible to fit everything into just 4 pants pockets. So nearly every Pua in the game had a prop bag. The contents of mine were as follows. 1 pack of gum, Wrigley's Big Red. Because no matter how good your game is, you're not going to get a kiss close if your breath reeks. 1 pack of condoms, Trojan, lubricated. This is necessary not only in case you have sex, but also for the psychological boost of knowing that you're prepared to. 1 pencil, 1 pen. These are for writing down phone numbers, taking notes, performing magic tricks, and analyzing handwriting. one piece of dryer lint. This is for the lint opener. Walk up to a woman, stop, wordlessly remove the lint, which is hidden in the palm of your hand, from her clothing, and ask, how long has that been there? Then hand her the piece of lint. One envelope of pre-selected photos. This is for Mystery's photo routine. One digital camera. This is for Mystery's digital photo routine. First, take a photo of yourself and a girl smiling, then another one striking a serious pose, and finally, one kissing on the cheek or lips. Afterward, look through the photos with her. At the final photo, say, we make a good couple, don't we? If she agrees, you're in. One box of Tic Tacs. This is for the Tic Tac routine. Put two Tic Tacs in your hand. Very slowly eat one. Then feed the second one to her. If she accepts it, say, there's something I forgot to tell you. I'm an Indian giver. I want my Tic Tac back. Then kiss her. Lip balm, cover up, eyeliner, blotting paper. These are for optional male makeup. Cheat sheet, 3 pages. This consists of 1 page of favorite routines for quick reference, 2 pages of new routines and lines to practice. One set of wooden runes in cloth bag. This is for rune readings. One notebook. This is for phone numbers, notes, magic tricks, and Ross Jeffries' crappy sketch artist opener, in which you very seriously draw a portrait of a girl, tell her, your beauty has inspired me to high art, and then show her a stick figure with a title like Semi-Pretty Girl in Coffee Shop, 2009. One cryptolite necklace. This is a glow-in-the-dark necklace for peacocking. 2 sets of fake ear and lip piercings. These are optional body adornment. 1 small digital recorder. This is for surreptitiously recording Sarges to play back and critique afterward. 2 spare necklaces, 2 spare thumb rings. These are to give to girls as gifts after a number close. Ask her, you're not a thief, are you? Then slowly remove your necklace or thumb ring, put it on her, kiss her, and say, this is still mine. It's something to remember me by. I want it back next time I see you. After she leaves, replace your jewelry with a spare from the bag. 1 small black light. This is for pointing out lint and dandruff on girls' clothing. An egg. 4 sample bottles of different colognes. These are for smelling good and for the cologne opener. Spritz a different cologne on each wrist, then have a girl smell your wrists and choose a favorite. Afterward, mark her choice on the appropriate wrist with a pen. Tally the results at the end of the night to find the best scent for yourself. Various magic tricks. These are for reading minds, making cigarettes vanish, and levitating beer bottles. Yes, I was bringing out the big guns. It was an important night. My first workshop as a wing, and I needed to prove myself. I had neglected to tell Mystery that his standard workshop fee was half the annual salary of the average Serbian, so most of our students were from out of the country. They met us at Benakiba, a lounge just off the central square in Belgrade. Exotic Option was an American who had taken a train from Florence, Italy, where he was going to school. Jerry was a ski instructor from Munich, Germany, and Sasha was a local who had been studying in Austria. Strangers size each other up in seconds. 100 tiny details, from dress to body language, combined to create a first impression. Mystery's task, and now mine, was to fine-tune the details and make puas out of these 3. Exotic Option was cool. In fact, he was trying so hard to be cool that it was going to work against him. Jerry had a great sense of humor, but came off on first impression as mundane. And Sasha, well, he was badly in need of repair. Just socializing was going to be a challenge for him. He looked like a big baby goose with acne. This time, it was my turn to go around the table and ask, what's your score? And what are your sticking points? And how many girls would you like to sleep with? Exotic Option, who was 20, had been with 2 women. I have the balls to approach, and I did pull some huns in the past, he began, draping his left arm casually over a neighboring seat. But my sticking point is the attracting phase. Even when I get vibes that I attract them, I still don't close. Jerry, who was 33, had been with 3 women. I can work coffee shops and most other low-noise environments, but I'm uncomfortable in clubs, he said. And Sasha, who was 22, said he had been with one woman, though he suspected he was exaggerating by one. I'm into the game because it's like Dungeons and Dragons, he explained. When I learn a neg or a routine, it's like getting a new spell or a staff that I can't wait to use. One by one, they placed their fears and their voice recorders on the table. My job was to get them into the game. I needed to get what was in my head into theirs. The teaching portion of the workshop was easy. All I had to do was give them material and keep Mystery on track. He loved the sound of his own voice. The challenge was going to be the demonstration part. As we spoke, we sent the boys on missions to various tables. We had them open sets. A set is a group of people in a public place. A two set, for example, is a group of two people. A three set is three people. Then we watched their body language and the responses of the women and gave them feedback. You were leaning into the set, which showed neediness. Stand up straight and rock on your back foot as if you might walk away at any moment. You were making them uncomfortable by hovering over them for so long. You should have sat down and given yourself a time constraint. Say, I can only stay for a couple of minutes because I have to rejoin my friend soon. That way, they won't worry that you're going to sit there all night. Sasha did the worst. He fumbled through his openers, stared at his shoes, and lacked even a modicum of confidence. Girls listened to him only out of politeness. At the bar, I noticed a delicate black-haired girl and a tall blonde with a perfect fake tan, deep dimples, and hair in Bo Derek braids. They radiated energy and confidence. This was not going to be an easy set, so I gave it to Sasha. Go into the two set over there, I instructed him. It didn't take any game to send guys into sets. Tell them you're showing some friends from America around and want suggestions for good clubs to take them to. It was a crash-and-burn mission. Sasha meekly approached them from behind and tried several times to get them to notice him. Once he had their attention, it was a struggle for him to keep it. Like many guys, he didn't communicate with energy. All those years of insecurity and social ostracism had chased his spirit and joy of life deep within his body. Whenever he opened his mouth, there was no need for anyone to strain to make out his faint mumblings. The message was clear. I was built to be ignored. Go in, Mystery said to me as he watched Sasha flounder with a Bo Derek blonde. What? Go in, help him out. Show the boys how it's done. Fear seizes hold in your chest first. It clamps gently to the top of the heart like a vice made of rubber. Then you really feel it. Your stomach churns, your throat closes, and you swallow, desperately trying to avoid the dryness and hoping that when you open your mouth, a confident, clear voice will emerge. Even after all my training, I was terrified. Women, by and large, are much more perceptive than men. They can instantly spot insincerity and bullshit. So a great pickup artist must either be congruent with his material and really believe it, or be a great actor. Anyone talking to a woman while simultaneously worrying about what she thinks of him is going to fail. Anyone caught thinking about getting into a woman's pants before she starts thinking about what's in his pants is going to fail. And most men fall into this category. Sasha does, I do. We can't help it. It's our nature. Mystery calls it dynamic social homeostasis. We are constantly buffeted about by, on one hand, our overwhelming desire to have sex with a girl, and on the other, the need to protect ourselves when approaching. The reason this fear exists, he says, is because we are wired evolutionarily for a tribal existence, where everyone in the community knows when a man is rejected by a woman. He is then ostracized, and his genes, as Mystery puts it, are unapologetically weeded out of existence. As I approached, I tried to push the fear out of my chest and rationally assess the situation. Sasha's problem was his body position. Both women were facing the bar, and he had approached from behind, so they had to turn around to respond. But if they wanted to get rid of him, all they had to do was to turn back toward the bar, and he'd be shut out. I looked back. Mystery and the other two students were watching me as I approached. I had to work the angles right. So I came in from the right side of the bar, next to the black-haired girl, the obstacle, as Mystery would say. "Hi," I rasped. I cleared my throat. "I'm the friend Sasha was telling you about. So, what clubs did you recommend?" I could sense a silent sigh of relief from all parties that someone had come in to make things less awkward. "Well, Reka is a fun place for dinner," the black-haired girl said. "And along the waterfront, there are some great boats, like Lucas, Cruz, and Exil. Underground and Ra are fun too, though they're not the kinds of places I go to. Hey, as long as we're talking, I want to get your opinion on something." I was on familiar ground now. "Do you think spells work?" By now, I was getting used to telling the spells opener, a story about a friend who fell in love with a woman after she surreptitiously cast an attraction spell on him. So, while my mouth moved, my brain thought strategy. I needed to reposition myself next to the Bo Derek blonde. Yes, I was going to steal my student's girl. It's not like he had a chance with her anyway. When I finished, I said, "I'm asking because I never believed in that stuff before, but I had an amazing experience recently. Here," I addressed the blonde, "let me show you something." I maneuvered myself around to the other side of their stools so that I was next to my target. Now that I was one-on-one with her, I still needed to sit down. Otherwise, she'd eventually get uncomfortable with me lurking over her. However, there weren't any open stools, so I'd have to improvise. "Give me your hands," I told her, "and stand up for a moment." As soon as she stood, I wheeled around behind her and slid into her seat. Now I was finally in the set, and she was lurking awkwardly on the outside. This was the science of approaching, perfectly executed, like a good game of chess. "I just stole your chair," I laughed. She smiled and punched me teasingly in the arm. The game had begun. "I'm just kidding," I continued. "Stay close. We'll try an ESP experiment. But I can only stay for a moment. Then you can have your chair back." Even though I guessed her number wrong, it was 10, she still enjoyed the process. As we talked afterward, Mystery walked up to Sasha and told him to keep the black-haired woman occupied so she wouldn't pull my target away. Marco was right. The girls were gorgeous here. They were also extremely bright and, much to my relief, spoke better English than I did. I truly enjoyed listening to this girl. She was captivating, well-read, and had an MBA. When it came time to leave, I told her it would be great to see her again before I left. She pulled a pen from her purse and gave me her phone number. I could feel Mystery's approval and the student's acceptance. Style was the real deal. Sasha was still talking to the black-haired girl, so I whispered in his ear, "Tell her we have to go and ask for her email." He did, and, lo and behold, she gave it to him. We rejoined the group and left the cafe. Sasha was a new man. Flush with excitement, he skipped down the street like a little boy, singing in Serbian. He was being, in his own awkward way, himself. He'd never gotten a girl's email address before. "I'm so happy," Sasha raved. "This is probably the best day of my life." As anyone who regularly reads newspapers or true crime books knows, a significant percentage of violent crime, from kidnappings to shooting sprees, is the result of the frustrated sexual impulses and desires of males. By socializing guys like Sasha, Mystery and I were making the world a safer place. Mystery, who had number closed a girl named Natalia, threw his arm around my neck and pulled my face into his wizard's overcoat. "You've done me proud," he said. "It's not just about getting the girl. It's about the students seeing it happen and believing it can be done." It was then that I realized the downside to this whole venture. A gulf was opening up between men and women in my mind. I was beginning to see women solely as measuring instruments to give me feedback on how I was progressing as a pickup artist. They were my crash test dummies, identifiable only by hair colors and numbers, a blonde 7, a brunette 10. Even when I was having a deep conversation, learning about a woman's dreams and point of view, in my mind, I was just ticking off a box in my routine marked rapport. In bonding with men, I was developing an unhealthy attitude toward the opposite sex. And the most troubling thing about this new mindset was that it seemed to be making me more successful with women. Chapter 7. Some girls are different. That's what Marco thought. After everything he'd seen during Mystery's workshop, he was in no way a convert. Gocha wasn't like these other girls, he insisted. She came from a good family, she was well educated, and she had morals, unlike that materialistic club trash. I'd heard it all before from dozens of guys, and I'd heard just as many intelligent women say, "That won't work on me," when I told them about the community. Yet minutes or hours later, I'd see them exchanging phone numbers or saliva with one of the boys. The smarter a girl is, the better it works. Party girls with attention deficit disorder generally don't stick around to hear the routines. A more perceptive, worldly, or educated girl will listen and think, and soon find herself ensnared. And so it was that Mystery and I found ourselves out on New Year's Eve with Marco and his one-itis, Gocha. Marco put on a gray suit, picked her up at 8 p.m., ran around and opened the car door for her, and handed her a dozen roses. She seemed like a bright, successful, well-bred girl. She was short with long chestnut hair, gentle eyes, and a smile that arced just a little wider on one side. Marco was right. She did look like the marrying kind. The restaurant was traditional Serbian fare, heavy on the red peppers and red meat, and the music was pure anarchy.